Hey, Trey here. Two things. First, I'm not sure if you know it, but Us and Them was honored with four Associated Press Broadcasters Awards, including one for excellence in public service through journalism. Second, it's the time for the Spring Pledge Drive at West Virginia Public Broadcasting. And if you value the work that our Us and Them team does in telling the stories about the things that divide Americans, would you consider making a pledge of support to West Virginia Public Broadcasting? You can call or text to 1-800-RADIO-87, or you can go online to WV Public and find the little red button at the upper right-hand corner. And when you pledge, let them know where you live and that you're a listener of Us and Them. Doing this would be a big help for our show and the other great programming at West Virginia Public Broadcasting. And thank you so much. Hey, this is Trey Kay, and you're listening to Us and Them. So I'm standing in a parking lot outside of a store here where a young African-American friend of mine recently had an encounter with the police. So is this a store?
Yeah, this is a store.
Look, I want to be straight up. My friend, let's call him Mike, he was up to some mischief, and we're not going to excuse him for that. But the cops didn't know what was going on. They were responding to a call claiming that these black males were dragging a lady across the parking lot.
My friend's stepmom was sitting here waiting for us to come out the door.
Now, this story is a little complicated, but what you need to know is that one of Mike's companions got into a physical altercation with his stepmother right in front of this store. And Mike and some of his other friends tried to stop the fight.
They was tussling all the way out here. We tried to spread them apart. And I separated them, and then...
Did you see people who saw this happening? Where were they standing?
They was standing, like, all around us. That little area right there by the trash can. And they were just standing there.
These bystanders are concerned. Mike's friend is black, but his stepmother is white. Folks get on their cell phones and call 911. Mike and his friends realize that this looks bad.
We just took off running. You could just see us running. All the way over there.
They're running to a place where some of their friends are waiting in a car.
As soon as we hopped in a car and we thought, oh, we just made it out, the cops just surrounded us.
The cops approach the car and command everyone to put their hands up on the roof inside the car. But Mike doesn't exactly get his hands up all the way.
My hands wasn't on the roof because my elbows was on my knees. So he thought I was digging for something, but I was just chilling. And then he was like, put your hands up before I shoot you. And I looked to my right by the window, and the gun is pointed to me. I put my hands up. They opened up the door. They just throw me on the ground. One cop had his knee on, like, my thigh and cuffed me, and the other one, like, had his hand on my shoulder and my face when my head was on the curve, so I wouldn't move or nothing.
So this is pretty scary stuff. A teenage kid is messing around with some of his friends and gets into a situation where he almost gets his head blown off by the police. This is a parent's worst nightmare. I know firsthand that it was Mike's mother's nightmare because she's also a friend of mine. And she's been trying to prepare him for this moment by giving him the talk. And to be more specific, the black talk.
Think about it, it's a white woman struggling with three or four black boys.
This is Mike's mother.
And the witnesses called in the call to the cops more heightened than what the situation really was.
She understands that he can seem like a threat to police, especially now since he stands around 6 feet tall.
When the cops showed up, they didn't know what they was expecting. They also told me that my son doesn't look like a 16-year-old, that he looks like an adult.
His mom had to go down to the police station to pick him up after the incident. She says the cops were very respectful to her and explained what they understood the situation to be.
They thought that it was some black men robbing a white woman, which we know could have went a whole nother way.
Mike's mom is in a frustrating situation. She's really angry that his actions got him into this predicament.
We talk about different current events. He know what's going on. He know about Black Lives Matter. So, I mean, he's not in a bubble.
Parents are always trying to provide their kids with some guiding wisdom.
Today we're hearing about another kind of foundational conversation that, for some Americans, might be more important than learning about where babies come from. The suggestion came from a listener who, after hearing the episode about the sex talk, said we should really do an episode on the black talk. It's the talk we have with our teenagers about how you conduct yourself if you're ever stopped by the police. Needless to say, to me, a white guy who has never thought about having this kind of talk with his kids, I found it eye-opening, and I was intrigued. When did black families start having these talks? What does one say in this talk? How old are your kids when you have it? And how do you teach them to be safe while keeping their dignity? At the top of the show, we heard from Mike, a teenage kid, and his encounter with the police after he and his buddies were up to some shenanigans. But this episode is not about how police are mistreating black kids. The reality is more complicated than just good guys versus bad guys. The fact is, if you are black, you are more likely to be stopped by the police. And as long as that is the reality in America, the black talk is necessary.
I have had that talk.
I gave my son the talk.
Do you want me to tell you about my talk?
The talk actually happens, I feel, in every family.
We always say it takes a village to raise a child because it really does.
Everybody that I know.
All the people of color.
My grandparents, my great-grandparents.
Cousins. My uncles and then.
I remember my father telling me this and my older brother this in the living room.
And my mother was just very emphatic.
I might have been 12.
It's basically my grandmother, you know, being that you're a young black man.
All of my peers were on the receiving end in some way, shape, or form of some conversation about the police.
You know, I think it was just sort of a rite of passage.
All of us have had some version of that conversation with our children.
They very easily could have been teaching me how to tie my shoes. It's just a life skill that you have to know how to navigate.
The color of your skin could get you pulled over automatically.
You're getting out in the world, you're going to be by yourself.
Being in a place at the wrong time.
You're going to encounter these things.
You have to know how to act.
If you're confronted with the police.
If you get
pulled over, you do exactly as you're told.
Be polite.
You don't talk back. Be respectful in your tone.
Yes, sir.
Answer the questions that you have to answer.
No, sir.
Put your hands up. Do everything that the cop says.
You follow instructions.
Don't do any quick movements.
Don't reach for anything.
Have your license, registration, everything in your hand.
Never let a police officer hand you anything.
Maintain eye contact. Keep your hands where they can see them.
You might wind up with your fingerprints on an object that doesn't have any relationship to you.
It's basically taking the error rate out of the situation.
The nervous cop, the anxious cop.
Sometimes cops are scared.
Is even more dangerous than the racist cop. They're going to respond without thinking.
This guy's not having a good day.
And respond out of fear.
But the cop told me if he was just a little bit more scared.
And mistakes me reaching for.
And he shot.
My license and registration that they just told me to get.
I could have been planning a funeral just that quick.
And I could end up dead here.
They have the power to do what they wish with you.
You know, even if you feel like you're being
disrespected,
that's not a time to go back at them.
And if there's a battle to be fought, then you survive the moment.
And fight that battle another day.
It begins about the time that you are about to drive.
This is Greg Taylor. He's been an educator in the Washington, D.C. area for the past 25 years.
Sometimes a little earlier than that, because sometimes you may be with a older sibling who's driving, so you have to know how to act if you get pulled over.
He told me about the time that he got the talk.
So in my case, the talk happened with me, with my grandma, and then my uncles, and then, of course, older siblings, about how to act, what to do if you get pulled over by the police.
Your grandmother sat down and had this talk with you, but what do you remember about the conversation?
This was part of many conversations we had in the living room. I remember her being really serious, getting really solemn and saying, okay, you all are getting older, you're starting to catch the bus, you're starting to explore the city, you're starting to go out on your own. So what I want you to do is to understand this is what you have to look out for. This is how you take care of yourself when you're away from home. If you're ever stopped by the police, be polite, you know, no matter what they say to you, even if you feel like they're harassing you, that's not a time to go back at them. You know, just answer the questions. So it was just a sort of a primer, basically, of how to survive that encounter and get back home. You know, I think it was just sort of a rite of passage in a sense.
Taylor is a father of three, and he's carried on this rite of passage with his two sons and his daughter.
So my middle son wanted to drive, turned 16. So, you know, it was time for us to have this talk with both of them and my daughter as well. Same talk that my grandma had. You're getting out in the world. You're going to be by yourself. Here's how you need to act in order to and make it home safely.
I really wanted to know what this talk might sound like. So I asked Taylor to pretend that I'm his middle son.
You're about to start driving now. And there's a possibility that you're going to be pulled over by the police. So tell me what you would do if you got pulled over by the police.
Well, I mean, yeah, they might pull me over. And I mean, I'm gonna be all right, Dad. I mean, I'm just going to take it as it happens.
So what does that mean? Tell me what that means.
Well, I don't know, Dad. I mean, I don't know. What do? They ask you for your driver's license and some papers, right? You know, I'm going to reach around in my glove box and get that stuff out and hand it to them.
So if you reach, you're giving them a reason to think you may be reaching for a weapon.
But I'm not a criminal.
It doesn't matter whether you're a criminal or not. What they're looking for is, are you reaching for something that could potentially hurt them? So here's what you do. When you get stopped by the police, first of all, you need to have your license and registration with you, proof of insurance, and that needs to be out somewhere in the car whenever you're driving so you don't have to reach for anything.
Where do I put it?
You can put it in the center console, or you can put it where you have your sunglasses. I keep it in the overhead console. And the next thing that you need to do, if it's nighttime, you roll down the windows, you turn on your dome lights.
But what if it's cold?
If it's cold, then you just have to be cold for a few minutes.
Yeah, I got to turn the dome light on? Why?
You're turning the dome light on so the police officer is not approaching the dark car. You also better keep your hands on the steering wheel. And before you do anything, make sure that you ask for permission to do so.
Dad, I have to tell you, I mean, I don't like this. I mean, it makes me feel like they're treating me like a criminal.
Well, like has nothing to do with it. If you want to get home safely every night, if you want to drive the car, period, this is something that you're going to have to do. When they stop you, they don't know that you're a good student. They don't know that you're a good kid.
And I am. I am a good student. I am a good kid.
And I understand that, but not everybody else in the world understands that. And these are just things that you're going to have to do in order to stay alive in those encounters.
I don't think that I'm going to be like Tamir Rice or Freddie Gray or anything like that. I mean, I'm not wearing a hoodie or anything like that.
No, but you wear hoodies sometimes. And Tamir Rice's family or Freddie Gray's family didn't think that they were going to end up the way they did either. Tamir Rice was playing with a toy gun in a park, 12 years old. Philando Castile. He was a registered gun owner. He told the police officer that he had his registration. I believe the officer told him to go ahead and reach for the registration. And the next thing you know, the shot started. So, you know, you can be a registered gun owner in a state where, you know, that's legal. The guy in Ohio, I believe, was walking around the Walmart with a toy gun. Ohio's an open carry state. So even that shouldn't have been an issue. I've seen pictures on the internet where, you know, guys are walking in coffee shops with automatic weapons, with rifles. So that shouldn't have been by itself an issue. And if you saw the video, you know, he wasn't even really given a chance to put the toy gun down before he was shot. The police officer ran around the corner and just started shooting.
I mean, in a way, you're like kind of making me think like, I don't even know if I want to go out of the house. It just sounds like everything's dangerous.
Well, everything isn't dangerous, but if you're ever in an encounter with a police officer, there are things that you're going to have to do in order to survive the encounter. And that's just the way of life. It's what I had to do. It's what your uncles had to do. It's what mom has to do when she goes out as well.
I mean, yeah, I agree with him 100%. I take those same precautions, and I think the majority of black people take those same precautions.
Dallas Staples lives in Charleston, West Virginia.
I've even thought in some circumstances, hey, let me get out of the car and put my hands on the hood. I'll tell you where my registration card is and where everything is, and you get it. I don't reach for anything. I have a federal firearms permit. I can carry a firearm in any state in the union. But I put my hands on the wheel and I tell them, what do you want me to do? What do you want?
If Staples sounds like he knows the routine, it's because he's a former police officer. In fact, he was the chief of police in Charleston, West Virginia from 1991 to 1995.
And I let them know if I have a weapon in the car and who I am. I did that even when I was a police officer. If I ever got stopped, the first thing I'd tell that officer is, I'm a police officer, I have a weapon in the car.
Dallas Staples is now retired. He understands the reality of driving while black, but he also empathizes with the cops whose jobs have become more dangerous in recent years.
All of the gun laws, I mean, you take West Virginia, where you can carry a concealed weapon with no permit. So that gives the right to any adult to have a weapon. So every police officer now has to assume that everyone they come in contact with, whether it's in an African-American community or a white community, has a weapon. And there's really nothing they can do about it.
I guess it would follow that law enforcement people are feeling uneasy in the line of duty.
Well, yeah, I think uneasy. They spoke out against these type of laws because it puts them in danger. It puts citizens in danger. I mean, you're trained to be, you know, vigilant if law enforcement officers overreact or react to a person with a weapon, especially in West Virginia. It's legal for them to have it. So what do you do? I mean, people get offended if an officer draws a weapon, but as I've said, you know, police officers have a right to go home at night, too, when they finish their shift.
This elevated danger means when people have an encounter with the police, it tends to be tense. Back in the 90s, one of the measures that then Chief Staples began was a new model of community policing, specifically designed so that the community could get to know the police officers as people in their neighborhood.
We put precincts in 5 or 6 communities in Charleston, and they were in the neighborhoods, and they interacted with it, and the people could come in, they could do police reports, they got to know the officers. Those are the kind of things that we did to kind of minimize those biases, where officers really got to know people, and especially people of color, that it really worked.
But did you come into the job knowing there probably is bias?
Not probably. I came in knowing from before I became chief, I witnessed the things that some police officers did and said. So it wasn't that it was everything was just hunky-dory. No, there were challenges.
The number of guns on the street, combined with the inherent racial bias that Staples described, is compounded by the stereotypes everyone consumes.
A lot of times, because of television shows that have characterized young African-American males as thugs, and a lot of the rap music at the time was identifying all young African-American males as gangsters and that they had a gangster mentality. And those are the kind of things when kids turn their hats backwards, you know, that sent signals. And it sort of reminds you back as how young whites were profiled in the 60s for having long hair during the hippie movement and how police treated them. These are the kind of things that police officers have to be careful trying to connect those things to people and assuming that because a person has their hat on backwards or their pants sagged, that they're a gangster. Now, you might not agree with the way they dress, but that doesn't identify them as a criminal. Just because they're portrayed that way on some movie, you can't transfer that to your community.
Former Charleston Police Chief Dallas Staples. After a short break, Jelani Cobb speaks about the historical scope of the talk. We'll also hear how one mother had to break it to her son that the police would soon see him as a threat.
Yeah, so Garrison would just run helter-skelter toward law enforcement just to witness and admire, and he's waving at the officer, he's thrilled to see the officer, and when he was younger, that was fine.
I'm Trey Kay, and this is Us and Them, which is supported in part by the West Virginia Humanities Council, the CRC Foundation, and the Daywood Foundation.
Music lifts us up and brings us together, even when we can't get together in person. Mountain Stage brings you live performances on the air, online, and in our podcast. They remind you how it feels to be in a live audience listening to live music. This is Larry Gross, host of Mountain Stage. Find a link to our stations and our podcast online at mountainstage.org.
You're listening to Us and Them. I'm Trey Kay. Before the break, we heard a former police officer describe how easy it is to condemn an entire community just by how they talk or dress, based on the behavior of a few individuals. Black parents know this all too well, and communicating this unfair reality is also part of the talk.
Be aware of the image that you are portraying and make sure it's what you intend to portray.
I tell my son you have to dress a certain way.
It sounds ridiculous.
You can't listen to certain type of music.
Pull your pants up.
There are other people.
Tighten your belt.
That fit that category you fit and do negative things.
People say they feel like the police view them all as suspects.
Even though you don't, people would just group us all and say.
That has been a common theme.
To you, you feel this is your identity, this is who you are, this is your culture.
It's kind of the lineup effect. Everyone is seen as.
But other people look at you as a criminal.
Either involved in something unlawful.
Other people identify you as trouble.
Or potentially involved in something unlawful.
You know, you walk in a store, they're watching you. They wouldn't watch somebody else.
Do I still believe in law enforcement? Yes.
Their job requires them to go into some pretty dangerous situations.
Just make sure that you know what you're projecting.
And to sometimes meet people who are up to no good.
And that you might be perceived as a threat and people might act on that.
The vast majority of the population that you encounter are not those people. Just like the vast majority of the police that everybody encounters aren't the ones who are using excessive force.
Well, I think having to point out to them that, you know, they don't get to go through life like everyone else, that they have to look at not just how they perceive the world, but how the world perceives them.
Felicia Bush is CEO of a nonprofit social service agency and mother of four. She's given each of her kids a version of this talk and feels confident that they understand the potential consequences.
Unfortunately, we don't have the luxury to say to our sons, our black sons, that if you do the same thing that your white counterpart does when you encounter law enforcement, you're going to have the same result. If you speak out for yourself or if you reach for something, one of you may walk away and one of you may be rolled away. Unfortunately, more often, the black kid that's the one who's laying there dead and his future snuffed out because of someone's perception of who he might be as opposed to who he actually was.
Felicia Bush's talk is more comprehensive than just encounters they might have with the police. She schooled them on the reality that as black kids, they're perceived differently no matter where they are or who they're with.
I wasn't even aware of it until my freshman year of college when I lived with my two best friends and the other remaining group of my friends were white.
Tyler Bush is Felicia's oldest son. He's a senior at West Virginia University.
Just like in the middle of the night, we'd be bored on like on a weekend and they'd be like, oh, let's run to Walmart. Now I'm laying in my dorm room bed with like shorts and a tank top and they'll just like get up, throw on shoes and like be ready to go out the door. And I'm like, oh, hold on, just let me get ready. And I didn't notice until like it kept happening. They can just get right up and, you know, put on a hoodie, like if it's cold on. And it was not something I did. I got a polo, khakis, whatever it was that would make me the most invisible or blendable within my group.
Vanilla.
Yeah. And it was crazy looking because I'm with like all of these white kids who are just dressed like, you know, in what we were just laying down and playing Call of Duty in. But then like I'm sparing shoes. Yeah, business casual dress just so I don't get followed.
So I'm just thinking like if I'm one of your friends who's playing Call of Duty with you, and we get this notion as a group that we're going to go to Walmart and everybody's like, okay, let's go. Got my keys. Let's jump in the car and go. And Tyler's like, whoa, you know, I got to change. I'm thinking, well, this guy is like fussy. He can't leave the house unless he's like looking fabulous or something like that. Yeah. And you're telling me that's not the case.
Oh, not the case at all. I just need to somehow blend in. And like, When you're a black person looking at it from the outside, it doesn't at all look like you're blending in because you're not dressing how you were just dressed or how any of your white friends are dressed. But like from a white person's perspective or like a person in the store, they're like, oh, okay, well, look at all those, you know, nice white men. Oh, and then they've got the nice black friend. But if I throw on a hoodie, like I love hoodies, never wear hoodies. Never do. Just don't. Especially like if I'm going somewhere in public, like I'll wear them in my room.
You really don't wear hoodies, do you?
I wear them in the house.
Tyler and his older sister, Amber, nod at each other. The whole family takes how they dress very seriously.
And now looking back, I notice like we're always like the best dressed looking family going to see a movie when all you really want to be is in sweatpants and like a hoodie.
Why are you the best dressed?
Because I have to be. To not get followed in a store.
To not look like a threat.
Speaking about being perceived as a threat, Felicia Bush is often concerned about her youngest, who is 15.
Garrison has always just had this love of law enforcement, and he could mimic any siren and drive you nuts. But, you know, he just, you know, loves what they did. If there was something going on, he would run helter-skelter toward it just to witness and admire. And he's waving at the officer. He's thrilled to see the officer. Yeah. And when he was younger, that was fine.
Why was it fine?
Because he was cute. And he was little, and, you know, it never even occurred to me that he would be perceived as a threat.
But Garrison's been growing like a weed, and that insatiable curiosity is now bound up in his 6-foot frame. One afternoon, he heard sirens in his neighborhood.
And he took off toward them, and when they saw him coming, and they pull up with their weaponry, and I'm like, Garrison, stop. And so when I got him and brought him back, and I had to say to him, they perceive you as a threat. You can no longer run toward law enforcement. And, you know, if you need help, that's one thing. You need to go yelling help. But you can't just approach them like that. You know, they're in that zone. And they're already poised for danger. But then they see this black kid who's big running at them. You know, you're not this cute little boy anymore that's not a threat. Yeah.
Well, can you tell me about that? I mean, well, first of all, let's talk about the law enforcement. Well, you always had a love for it?
Yeah, I just like, you know, law enforcement, and I just find it interesting, and yeah.
And is she right? I mean, would you, like, you know, go tearing after, you know, a cop car and stuff
that? Yeah, I definitely would.
You look strong. Like, you know, I could see where somebody would see you as a threat.
Yeah, definitely.
Definitely you feel like a threat?
No, but like I can understand where they're coming from. Like, now that I look at it, I understand how they would see it.
A few months later, Garrison discovered firsthand just how he could be perceived by the police. He and his sister Skylar were riding home from a basketball game with two white friends. One of whom was driving, the other was in the back seat with Garrison. Skylar was in the front passenger seat. Her boyfriend wasn't a great driver. He was driving like an old granny in the fast lane and holding up traffic.
But we noticed that a cop was following us for like 30 minutes. He followed us. And Garrison and my friend kept looking back. And I'm like, not looking back because I don't want to cause any attention. I kept saying, stop looking back, guys. And I'm like, nothing's happening in this car. Act normal. Finally, the cop turns on the sirens. We slow down, pull over to the side. He gets out of his car. They're still looking back at the cop. So it looks like a little suspicious.
The officer comes to the window and explains why he pulled them over. While this is going on, Garrison is in the back seat acting kind of nervous and anxious. He's staring intensely at the cop.
The cop looks at Garrison and goes, do you have something you need to say to me? And he's like, no. And he goes, I noticed that you kept looking back at me the entire time.
Skylar notices that the cop has focused on her brother. When he goes back to his car, she takes control of the situation.
And I'm sitting there and I'm like, okay, guys, just be respectful, you know, and everyone else just stop talking. I will do the talking because I'm like, I know how I'm supposed to act in this situation. Stop talking.
The thing is, her white girlfriend in the back of the car also kept looking back at the cop. What's more, she was giggling nervously. and Skylar's boyfriend was being kind of rude to the officer. But for whatever reason, this went unnoticed by the officer. He was just focused on the tall black kid in the back seat.
Anyways, the cop comes back, and then he goes to Garrison again. Do you have a problem with me? You just keep staring at me. Is there a problem? Is there something I should know in the car? And my thought is, oh my lord, he's gonna like ask us to get out of the car, think there's drugs or something. And I'm like, no, sir, there's nothing you need to know about. My little brother just has anxiety, so this situation is not comfortable for him. And I remember after the cop finally leaves and tells us, okay, just go ahead and whatever. And I remember Garrison's reaction afterwards was like, why didn't he say anything to her? Like, why, like to my friend? And he's upset about it. He's upset because he's like, why did he come after me? Like, I wasn't doing anything. All I did was say, no, I'm not, I don't have an issue.
This is an example of the talk being put into practice. Skylar had really absorbed her mother's message in a way that Mike hadn't in the scene that we heard at the top of the show, or that Garrison wasn't conscious of at this point. And her white friends were clueless that they were exposing Skylar and her brother to potential danger.
So what we're talking about is, when we say the talk, in this particular instance, is just one thread of a much longer series of dialogues.
Jelani Cobb is a journalist and historian who writes for the New Yorker magazine. Back in 2016, he was part of a frontline documentary called Policing the Police. He believes that examining the relations between the police and people of color is paramount to understanding current race relations in America. But he's interested in more than just how black people comport themselves around law enforcement.
Richard Wright wrote an essay called The Ethics of Growing Up in Jim Crow. And it really gets at this bigger question because it's really the ethics of how you navigate racism in American society. And, you know, policing is the institution that we're most visibly, I guess, concerned with in terms of this conversation, but by no means is it exclusively that. And so there was a version of this, not simply in, you know, American cities, but in, you know, pre-Great Migration and post-Reconstruction and in the context of slavery, where people are trying to explain to their children how you survive in this system that's stacked against you. And so I think that we could have some version of this relating to education. We could have some version of this relating to, you know, employment, you know, some version of how it is that you best comport yourself to minimize the negative impacts of racism. And of course, it gets more complicated than that because another part of it is to ask why you should have to comport yourself in any particular way. Why should the onus be on you? I don't care if you think I'm suspicious. I don't care if you think I'm intimidating. Like, that's not my burden. And I decided I was not going to live my life trying to assuage the fears of racist white people, even as I kind of respect what the talk was about, but I feel like it's not my place to try to make someone else feel comfortable.
I've always really been more concerned with how my children see themselves.
I'm trying to teach him how to see through muddy waters.
Every parent wants every one of their children to feel loved, to feel important.
No one is better than you.
They can go anywhere in the world and
be free and
explore like everybody else.
You are responsible for making your own dreams come true.
Do your best and work hard and
overcoming any barriers that are put in your way.
You can do all these things, but
you can't let them think that it's sunshine and flowers either.
There's not really a reason for them to fear for their lives.
But you don't want them to be afraid to come out of your house.
Also, I don't want to beat him down or inferiority thoughts.
It may not make you feel good inside. It may not make you feel good about yourself at that particular moment.
I believe in freedom. Yeah, I believe in right. Yeah, I believe what I should have. But the reality is it really set like that?
But the ultimate goal is for you to get home safe. You know, it tears me up inside that I have to say these things to my kids.
It may be hard to hang on to a sense of dignity and self-esteem when the current political rhetoric encourages law enforcement to disregard an individual's basic rights.
When you see these thugs being thrown into the back of a paddy wagon, you just see them thrown in, rough. I said, please don't be too nice. Like when you guys put somebody in the car and you're protecting their head, you know, the way you put their hand over. Like, don't hit their head, and they've just killed somebody, don't hit their head. I said, you can take the hand away, okay?
In the weeks following President Donald Trump's 2016 election, there were several incidents on the WVU campus that made Tyler Bush feel uneasy and afraid. He says there were students who were excited and animated about the promise of the nation's new leader. Tyler said these people were like a modernish KKK, and they were harassing women, Muslims, gays, and people of color. This troubled him so much that he wanted to leave college and come back home. Although this really troubled her too, Felicia Bush saw this as another opportunity to have the talk with her kids in the form of a letter.
Okay, to my children. I recall not very long ago sharing family stories with you. I wanted to make sure you did not take your freedom to pursue your own dreams for granted. I wanted you children to understand the sacrifices, the struggle, and the daily humiliations that your grandmother, great-grandparents, your aunts and uncles endured, even as they fought oppression and bigotry and pressed forward toward a self-defined identity. I wanted you to grasp the significance of the choices you get to make about your education, about who you date, who you love, where you go, where you live, what profession you decide to pursue, etc. I wanted you to appreciate the freedoms that you enjoy because of the efforts of those that came before. Never in a million years did it occur to me that you would have to fight this fight all over again. Never did I think these remembrances were anything more than an homage to those who lived and worked and died to assure that you had the same opportunities as your white counterparts. But it's very clear that America is not the melting pot we hoped she was. It's clear that America is a pot boiling over with hatred and fear and rage. So, my children, rather than remember and honor in 2017, you have to rise up and fight. You have to call it what it is and fight oppression and injustice wherever you find it. You cannot allow anyone to diminish you or anyone else because of their race, religion, nationality, gender, sexual orientation, or for any other reason. Someone trumps up to diminish another. Every parent wants their child's life to be better, and I thought you were well prepared for living your life on your own terms. But anything worth having is worth fighting for, and fight you must. For yourselves and for anyone unable to fight for themselves. As horrible a thought as it is, as much as it breaks this mother's heart, I am strengthened by the fact that you have what you need to fight this fight. It is in your DNA. You can overcome this attack on humanity by holding fast to your own humanity, by standing with any who are being oppressed against any oppressor. Your family didn't just leave you with the stories of the struggle, my loves. They left you with a blueprint to victory. Never, ever give in. Never, ever give up.
As Felicia Bush read this letter, the emotion in the room was palpable. Several of her kids wept as they heard her read this again. That letter is a statement of current times, but it's also a nod to those who came before. Just a few decades ago, the civil rights struggle began to give African Americans a voice, their voice. That voice now calls out Black Lives Matter in a fight against police brutality and misconduct, and comes from a new generation of leaders. For decades, Reverend Ronald English was the head of the First Baptist Church in Charleston, West Virginia. Now he's retired, but he's still involved in social justice issues and works to bridge the Black community with law enforcement in that city. But once he worked with civil rights leaders, including Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., to bring people together. I sat down with Reverend English not too long ago in the mobile recording studios of the StoryCorps project to talk about that experience. He says Dr. King's nonviolent approach sought action with words, with preaching, and sometimes with music.
They invited some members of the youth corps to come over. And he was showing how he could also be very approachable, very entertaining, and that kind of thing. So he sat down at the piano and started playing, you know, the Moonlight Sonata. You know, he said, well, that's cool. But then when he just kind of shifted into the boogie woogie. We said, that's really cool. So, it was really awesome. Almost like the shift he made in his famous I Have a Dream speech.
Well, say more.
Because that wasn't intended as his ending. He felt like he had used that. In fact, he had used that in Detroit when Aretha Franklin had been a part of drawing him there, you know, for a mass rally that they called a march. And Mahalia Jackson had knew of that speech. And so she had preceded him in the March on Washington. So when he got to the point where he was getting ready to end, Mahalia said, tell him about the dream, Martin. Tell him about the dream. And he shifted and went into that I Have a Dream speech, which was the shift of the century. You know, I mean, that's what kind of earmarked the speech.
I have a dream that one day, down in Alabama with its vicious racists, with its governor having his lips dripping with the words of interposition and nullification. Yeah. One day right there in Alabama, little black boys and black girls will be able to join hands with little white boys and white girls as sisters and brothers. I have a dream today.
In a way, what you're saying is that Reverend King just didn't write everything out. He was somebody
who... Oh, no. That was one of the things I was fascinated by when he would preach. He didn't have any notes. Sometimes that was because he had preached that sermon, you know, several times, but he never had, you know, a manuscript that he was preaching from.
It was clearly somebody who could improvise.
Right? Oh yeah. That was one of his unique characteristics of being able to improvise on the spot.
Got here to Charleston, West Virginia. What was Charleston like in 1972?
Now, first of all, I was very surprised when I first came to Charleston that a black church was located downtown.
Right.
First Baptist would be the kind of church you would expect to be out.
On the outskirts.
Yeah, on the outskirts. So that was an interesting history in terms of how it had been located downtown all the time. But not far from there was the Triangle District.
Yeah.
And they had moved out a lot of residents of the Triangle District that were predominantly black.
It was the part of town that had the high concentration of African-American people. There were African-American churches. It was the black part of town.
Washington Street in that area of the East End was kind of known as the block. So they had barbershops. They had a hotel over there at one time. Theaters over there, and all that was the block was the center of attention and entertainment and connection.
During our conversation, we also talked about how the black neighborhood of Charleston was ripped apart with urban development, including an interstate highway and a shopping mall. But Reverend English says that he experienced a different kind of racism in West Virginia than in other parts of the South.
There were not set legal boundaries that black folk felt when they moved into a white space that they were putting their lives at risk.
Right.
As it was, you know, deeper down south, like where I came from.
So, like, you're talking about, like, the integrated Triangle District where there were black and white people over there.
Right? Oh, yeah. And frankly, in certain parts of West Virginia, even now you can see how mixed couples, mixed marriages, you know, have given breed to very white-looking, light-skinned folk. And so that kind of integration was going on at that time. So I called West Virginia up south.
Up south. But, wait, amplify on that. What do you mean by up south?
Well, it has certain patterns of southern... the southern mindset, so to speak, and it has certain patterns of racial separation, but they were not expressed in brutal forms. It was a more subtle kind of racism which I think is still around, prevalent. Yeah.
So you get here, as you described, there was like this vacant patch of land here that, right. that was in the middle of the town. And you're pastoring a church. What were people thinking? What were people saying in your congregation? Were they still reeling having this part of town kind of just wiped away?
Yeah, that's an interesting question because it was an economic picture that was supposed to be the kind of like selling point, that if you had a mall that was also at the intersection of major highways, then that would be a boon for the downtown area. And therefore, it would be a boon for everyone as far as the economic development. So I think that at that point, that was a willingness on behalf of the black community. Okay, we'll see how this works. Some were, I mean, particularly homeowners, you know, naturally would be upset. But if that was a fair trade for the, if that was a fair price for the property. So it wasn't like an urban renewal revolt.
Yep. Now we're 50-some years later, and it's like, okay, we kind of trace back and we say, okay, this is the point where we think things really didn't go well for the African-American community.
Oh, yeah. Because I was a part of a national movement, I mean, as far as urban development after integration and that kind of thing was supposedly paving the way for that kind of economic urban development. And so urban renewal authorities were set up to make sure that the law was attended to in terms of what would be a fair price and what would be resources available for that, for them to make a relocation out of the district that were being destroyed.
Do you think things have gotten better or worse in the 50 years here as far as how this us and them that's divided by race here in West Virginia, has it gotten any better? Has it gotten worse?
When I came here as pastor of First Baptist Church and folk knew of my association with Dr. King, I was given access to certain organizations. But the problem was that it was kind of like access by representing. And after a while, I came to resent that, because I wondered whether people were looking at me or looking through me through to King,
right.
and felt that because of my association with him, that I would be a good representative of the black community. So in that sense, it was a kind of a tolerance of a representative. And so therefore, you wonder about the integrity of the invitation.
Right.
And you wonder about the intention of the organization when, in fact, certain things hadn't changed.
So because you had kind of been under Dr. King, it was like, here's like a little detail on his resume that will kind of make this seem as though this is a real conversation or something like that. And you're basically just ticking a box as opposed to sitting down and let's talk about what are the issues.
Yeah. By me being new to the territory, it was kind of like, well, I wanted to take it seriously, you know, and felt at first that it was a genuine, but then became suspect of the intention.
One of the things that the privilege would say, look, you know, if we can just have this culture center or this shopping mall or this whatever, you know, it's all going to be good for everybody. And if you can just wait a little bit.
Yeah.
And it seems like the lesson that I've learned from crossing the us and then divide is that people of color have been waiting a long time.
Oh, absolutely. Long time. And still waiting. Yeah. Still waiting. I think that has aggravated their irritation with waiting.
Yeah.
And that's why I think we're seeing a more aggressive response to some of the issues in urban America, and particularly here, than we've seen before.
That's Reverend Ronald English, who's native to Atlanta, Georgia, and who served as assistant minister to Drs. Martin Luther King Jr. and Sr. And then he came to my hometown of Charleston, West Virginia, and pastored the First Baptist Church. I'm standing in Charleston, right in the place that was once known as the Triangle District.
Here, like in plenty other cities across the country, black working class neighborhoods were raised in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s to build interstate highways, shopping malls, and other forms of so-called urban renewal. These projects came with promises. Retail malls like the Charleston Town Center, which is just across the street from me, brought in new economic opportunities for some areas. I remember when this mall opened up back in the early 1980s with lots of excitement and fanfare. The footprint of the place was huge. It takes up several city blocks right in the heart of downtown. And some reports at the time said that the mall was the largest downtown mall east of the Mississippi. But as an economic engine for the city, its prospects have dimmed. The mall recently sold at public auction with a bid from only one buyer. Its anchor stores are in flux. Sears pulled out a couple of years ago as part of reorganizations and bankruptcies, and reports say that Macy's will close its store here. Competition from online sales has turned the retail market inside out. So what about the promises that were made from urban renewal projects? As an economic experiment, urban renewal projects have been redefined over the decades. And what about the neighborhoods and residents who were forced to move? Well, generations later, the relocation of communities of color never lived up to the early promises. And today, the loss of such culturally diverse neighborhoods is the tragic legacy. You've been listening to Us and Them. Our team for this show is me, Trey Kay, Loretta Williams, Mitch Hanley, Kate Smith, Rima Snyder, and Eric Malinsky. Special thanks to the folks from Harlem, New York, Washington, D.C., and different parts of West Virginia who shared their experiences of the talk. And thanks to Jacqueline Van Meter and Madison Mullen of the StoryCorps Project for use of our conversation with Reverend Ron English. Michael Lipton and Tristan Lozow wrote and performed the Us and Them show music. Mark Lerner designed our logo. The wonderful people at PRX and West Virginia Public Broadcasting make Us and Them possible. So do grants from the West Virginia Humanities Council, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the CRC Foundation, and the Daywood Foundation. We'll see you next time on Us and Them.
Support for this podcast comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.